How is everyone tonight? Okay. So welcome to another couple of lectures tonight, and I think a week from Thursday, turns out, right? Because next Thursday, day after tomorrow, there's a puja, and next Tuesday, there's also several rituals here. So we'll have a concluding talk a week from Thursday, and we're going to be talking about karma. Karma. I'll talk a little bit more later, so we'll begin with a little meditation, as we usually do. So sit comfortably. Relax your body. Relax your mind. Remind yourself everything is okay. In the big scheme of things, whatever you might be worried about or problems, plans, leave them aside for the time being. And just begin with the skillful method that the Buddha taught of watching, observing your breath. Maybe observing sounds better. Watching almost sounds like you do it with your eyes. Without controlling, with wisdom that recognizes the difference between an inhalation and an exhalation. Holding that object with mindfulness, the magnet or glue of mindfulness. Being alert if you stray from the breathing. Let go of your other thoughts. Just observe the breath. Thank you. Your mind is a little bit calmed. Follow one respiration down to your heart chakra. Leave your attention there, let go of the breathing, and just watch with the mental consciousness, watch the rest of the mental consciousness. You can either think of a little part of your mind as a spy, noticing the content at first, like the people in a room or the fish in an aquarium. And even from the very beginning, let go of your attention to the fish-like thoughts, images, emotions in your mind, and try to sense the space between them, spaciousness, clarity. See if that can bring back a remembering consciousness of this mental image we're building up of the clear light nature of the mind. Here it's not a distant memory, it's being based every moment on observing the thoughts coming and going, and when they're not there, the clarity, the mirror-like reflectivity of the mind. Establish mindfulness of the object. Once you've recognized it a couple of times, the clarity of the mind, you have some image of it, try to hold that. If you lose it, use some reasoning or analysis to try to get a sense of it again, and then hold it with this mental glue, a magnet of mindfulness. Sometimes you may stray from the object, lose it, so to speak, as though your mind has wandered off some thoughts. You can use those thoughts as an aid. Those thoughts are appearing within the consciousness. They're the nature of consciousness. They're not mind itself. They're not subjects. And so forth. Let them dissolve back into the spaciousness of the mind, recognizing them as the nature of the mind, like waves on the surface of the ocean. The substance of the waves is also water. They dissolve back into the ocean eventually. Just use your mind to recall that they are the nature of the mind. Let go of paying attention to them. Try to perceive the nature of the mind that's apprehending them. So that's knowing them. And that mind that's knowing them has this clear light nature. Spaciousness of mind, it's clear light nature, it has no shape or color. It's something perceived by the mind itself. It's not an object of the eye or the ear. Even the mental image you have of the spaciousness is yet like a thought within the consciousness. Let go of that and try to perceive more directly this clarity within which that thought was arising. Successively letting go again and again. If at a point the body, the appearance of your body dawns in your consciousness, recognize that that's being known by your mind via a mental image, thought. Let go of that. You may have to do again and again. Just perceive the consciousness, the subjective consciousness that is the matrix within which these thoughts arise. Subtle than the appearance of your body, there may still be an appearance, a sense of the observer, you, yourself. As though observing or enjoying this experience of the mind. Ask yourself, who's meditating? Or if you think, I'm having a bad meditation, or I'm having a good meditation, or I'm having an average meditation, that I, How does that appear within this clarity of your mind? Don't dismiss it immediately. Although sometimes we just try to let go of it. Here, let it dawn. Try to investigate how it's appearing. Deep down, as though something other than the mind existing by itself, under its own power. Certainly nothing as rainbow-like or superficial as just a name. Something that seems to have some pointable substance to it. Something we could point out, find. This is even more subtle than watching just the nature of the mind itself. We've gone from the breath to a first approximation of the clarity of the mind, seeing within the mind, for instance, the thoughts and then even the appearance of the body. Now something even more subtle. You have to really, as though diving into the mind, boring down. In the same way that you tried not to control the breath, you just tried to observe it. Here, don't try to fabricate some sense of I. See if you can observe it. The sense of an observer, the thinker, the meditator, you. Although that sense of I may take different forms. It might be, as in your mind's eye, it might appear to be a shape like your body or some facet of your mind. In the end, even more subtle than those, is just a sense of the I existing there by itself. That's what you're going to try to hold now with this mindfulness. This appearance, subtlemost appearance of the eye, has been with us since beginningless time in different forms, whether we are ants or deer or hell beings or hungry ghosts or gods, slightly different, still that sense of an identity existing from its own side, the owner of our body and mind, the enjoyer. But something there that sense of I successful and have a little luck in observing, even fleetingly, that sense, try to hold it. Try to see how the consciousness is reacting to that appearance. Perhaps very passively, just accepting that it really is there. Let go of that and just again rest in the clear light nature of your mind for a few moments. This is what the Buddha referred to as the conventional Buddha nature. It's this conventional clear light nature of the mind that can transform and develop all the good qualities. They can arise within this mind. Those qualities that as yet we have not developed, that we might appreciate, we might have a desire to develop, and we can get rid of the faults that still permeate our mind, our self-interest, egotistic attitude, our ignorance, attachment, anger, hatred, jealousy, pride, low self-esteem, paranoia. Oh, all this can be eradicated from the mind because it doesn't abide in the nature of this clear light mind. By applying the right antidote, we can uproot those states of mind. And we have an opportunity right now with a life of a human. In this southern continent, we call this the southern continent, Jambudvipa, it's a world. The Buddha's teachings still exist. We're a human being with freedom to practice. We're not oppressed with states of suffering of hell beings or animals or hungry ghosts or even the complacency and darkness of mind of the long life gods. But this state of life of leisure endowment is not eternal. We'll have to leave it at some point. So to take the advantage of it, to take the essence of this life, the opportunity that it affords that we haven't really thought about until now, to heal ourselves, to become less a problem for ourselves and for others, and then to actually benefit. I think I'm going to participate tonight and next class to really understand the conventional right view, the view of karma, of actions and their results. I'm going to do so not just for intellectual interest, but to heal myself, for the sake of becoming enlightened, from which point I could most perfectly help sentient beings, effortlessly, spontaneously. Within that clear light state, again, relax your attention, bring it back to the present. How are you doing? Any observation? How was your meditation? The lady in the red shirt and the sitting on the chair, you know, how was your meditation? Like this or this or this? A little bit like this, okay. So I'm not sure. This, if you did it slowly, that would be like so-so, but you went. This is like agitated. Anyone have any observation or comments about the meditation? I know you're all shy. Okay.
Excuse me, Venerable, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Here?
Yes, yes.
Yes, because you mentioned in this meditation and other meditation, you mentioned conventional clear light mind.
Right.
Yeah, can you please explain a little bit on what is this conventional clear light mind, or are you referring to it's conventional is because it's related to this life?
Well, sometimes the word clear light, when it's referring to some of higher practices, is referring to the ultimate nature of the mind, which is emptiness, which also appears, if one were to perceive it, like space. So there's when we can develop an ability to activate the subtlemost mind that resides within us now, that we're presently unaware of. The mind that continues on after this lifetime. The consciousness that we have right now, as we say, is a gross consciousness. It absorbs every night when we go to sleep, sort of pulsates out again tomorrow, maybe during the dream state. It gets a little subtler. But at the time of death, the gross mind right now that we were watching the gross mind, the nature of this gross mind of this life. Which has this spacious appearance, it looks like space, non-obstructing, we call the conventional clear light nature of the mind. Even the subtle mind, the subtlemost mind, also has a similar appearance. It also has a conventional appearance of being spaciousness, spacious when we die, that subtle most mind also appears in a similar way to the gross mind that we're trying to recognize now. But at the time of death, that the clear light of death, that mind, it appears without any kind of thoughts interfering. We don't have to sort of hold, you know, try to find it and hold it with mindfulness and so forth, because no other conceptuality is going on, no thoughts that interfere. Both this gross mind and that subtle mind appear like clear light, and those are both conventional natures that's appearing. Both of them are empty of existing the way that they appear. What we're trying to train now is to maybe leave an imprint for some further practice in the future when we can activate that subtle most clear light mind and meditate, recognize it as, you know, as appearing as though it existed by its own, and to recall the meaning of emptiness, that it doesn't exist that way. That would be the ultimate, what we call the sun clear light. Not sun like the sun in the sky, but the sun of a mother. S-O-S-O-N. Sun clear light. So that would be that. The emptiness of the mind is, generally we say, is our Buddha nature. This conventional clear light, which is not the emptiness, is just the conventional truth. This is what we call the Dalai Lama said we can call the conventional Buddha nature. Generally, when we talk about this term Buddha nature, we talk about two things. The developmental Buddha nature, that's sort of what we're recognizing here, the clear light nature of the mind, the fact that it is, things can move within it, virtuous minds can arise, negative minds can be eliminated, it is not stained by the temporary faults that we have, anger, attachment, ego, strong ego grasping, and so forth. That's sometimes called the developmental Buddha nature. But the actual Buddha nature refers to the emptiness of the mind. The fact that it appears that it has this developmental nature, but it is empty of even existing the way that it appears. In the same way that a mirage, you know, looks, you know, you can't refute that the mirage appears. It does appear, but it is empty of water. Once you have understood that, you're not fooled by that appearance. Anyway, enough of that. Okay. So
thank you.
These two talks tonight and a week from Thursday are on the topic of karma. This is a lot that to be said about karma. Some of you have already studied a lot about karma. The Buddha himself said that the right view of understanding our actions, karma, right, and their results, the right understanding of that, developing a confidence, trust, and faith in that is what's called the... Again, we say the worldly correct view or the mundane correct view. Usually when we say correct view, what is that referring to? You know, when we talk about the right view or correct view, the Eightfold Noble Path, what is the right view of? The view of what? Malacca? The right view of Singapore, or is it the right view of emptiness, right? Usually that's what we say, the right view of selflessness or emptiness. That's usually what we say. We could call that, to be more specific, that's the supramundane right view, the transcendental right view, the ultimate right view, you know, the superior right view. But until we realize that right view of emptiness, the view of karma, the understanding of the law of cause and effect with regard to our own actions and their results. There's many kinds of cause and effect, right? Did you study in, what would it have been, here in Singapore, maybe elementary school or high school, Newton's laws of motion? Which law of motion is it? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Which one is that? Second? So we have a PhD here. No, a third? You're changing. Okay. You have to check. Is it second? No. Mabel's not sure. I thought she was going to clear that up. You have to check. So every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You know what that means in the world, right? If you're on a skating rink, or roller skates, or on the ice, and another person is next to you, if you push on them with an action, actually you get pushed away too, right? Did you notice that? A rocket, the fuel being thrust out one end, that's an action, it has an equal and opposite reaction. It thrusts the rocket upward, right? Without separating that fuel, burning that fuel, pushing it out this way in one direction, the rocket won't go up. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If you play billiards or golf or whatever, tennis. So there's a similar kind of law in the world of the mind. For every mental action we create, which may motivate actions of body, you know, and speech, like saying, lying, or saying praise, or hitting, or you know, giving medicine and helping. Every mental action also, the Buddha said, has a reaction in kind. So is it equal and opposite reaction when we talk about Newton's law of motion, right? So when in karma, here I'm using from some of the other courses, I've used things from Jeffrey Hopkins' book, Meditation on Emptiness. Here I'm using from Geshe Lundub Zopa's commentary to the Lanrim Chamo, in case you have that and you want to check, you can go into more detail. I think it's volume 2, second chapter, around page 35 to begin with. So the varieties of karma. So, first we're going to talk about the general aspect of karma, which is, so to understand karma and its results is said to be the mundane correct view. So if we have faith in this, this is the basis at the beginning of our practice. Once we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, what are we supposed to do? Is that all we do? We just say, oh, I take refuge in Buddha. We're just praying for some help or something like that. The main thing we have to do is when we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we have to take refuge in the actual Dharma. What's the actual, the actual refuge of those three, most important, is the Dharma. The Dharma is what protects us from suffering. What's the main thing that protects us from suffering? Well, the mundane view and the supramundane view, correct view. The mundane view, what protects us from suffering, is understanding karma and its results so that we can avoid negative actions, negative karma, and actually create virtuous actions. That protects us from suffering. Right now, you might say, well, that's something that's going to happen in the future. But right now, they can protect us from suffering also, because your mind becomes calm, abstaining. When we talk about observing our actions, what that means is with a mind that understands the correct mundane view, that means the view of karma and its results, understands that negative actions will have repercussions. So if I don't want to suffer, I should avoid those. And understanding that virtuous actions done with authentic motivation, not some artificial fake virtuous motivation, but done with virtuous motivation, those actions will have repercussion on us. Equal and opposite reaction, they'll bring something pleasant to us in the future. So this is the first step. You know, you might have heard all of these different teachings. What do you do in practice? Once you've developed confidence and faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as objects of refuge, the main refuge is the Dharma. That's, you know, the Buddha taught the Dharma. The Sangha helps us take the medicine of the Dharma. But the Dharma is like the real medicine. And the first practice of the Dharma is this mundane correct view, the view of karma and its results. So it's very important. When I've taught in America, other countries, there seems to be a movement now, sort of in the West, people want to, there's a big movement in mindfulness training. Have you heard? You know, a big thing in business people, lawyers, you know, they go to these retreats that cost tens of thousands of dollars in Big Sur or someplace. They just extract from the Buddha's teachings some meditation, watching the mind or something. But they sometimes disdain or demean actual practice of morality, ethics. So this is the first practice of ethics, morality. Restraining from negative actions and creating virtuous actions. For some people, that's not important. You know, that's just, oh, that's old, ancient Buddhism, you know, hocus pocus or some spiritual kind of thing. We just believe in the here and now, you know, some Western scientists would say. There's also a disdain of the existence or the need to believe in reincarnation in that kind of modern mindfulness movement. It's something you have to be aware of. So here we're talking about the, in American lingo, we would say the nitty-gritty. Maybe do you still use that? This is the real essence. So in terms of a general presentation of karma, so karma, mundane correct view. To understand the super mundane correct view, we talk about the Four Noble Truths. Four. Here there are four main outlines also to talk about karma. That karma is definite, like we say, the First Noble Truth. Karma is definite. The results of karma, when we say karma, when we're saying karma here, we're referring to both the action itself. We're being a little vague at the beginning. Karma itself means action, right? So when we perform an action, let's say even the mental motivation for something, we leave an imprint on our being, we could say in our consciousness, like a seed. That seed is called a karmic seed. So sometimes when we say karma, we're referring to the seed. Sometimes when we talk about karma, like if something bad happens to you, your wallet is stolen and someone says, oh, that's your karma. It refers to, that's the ripening of the seed. So sometimes karma refers to the production of karma, the production of the action. Sometimes it refers to the imprint it leaves in our mind, the seed. Sometimes karma is referring to the result of that seed when it ripens in your own experience. Okay? So first, karma is definite. Karma is expandable. There's no way to experience a result of karma without having created the cause, without having created the karma yourself. And karma is never is lost, is never decays in your consciousness. Once you've created an action, you've left an imprint in your mind. Unlike ordinary seeds, like in America, I go to a garden shop to buy seeds to plant in my garden, tomato seeds or cucumber or arugula. I like arugula. Do you know what arugula is? I think they call it here. What do they call it? Rocket. It's nice. Anyway, I buy seeds. If the seeds sit in my cabin for a year or two, they start to lose their potency, right? Maybe if I don't look at the label, it still looks fresh, and maybe it's from 5 years ago. It's not going to. Some of the seeds may give a little bit of sprout, but not much. Unlike that, karmic seeds that we plant in our consciousness have no expiry date. Expiration date? Like the medicine you buy in the store, it has, or the food you have, used before a certain date, right? Karma doesn't have that quality. It will remain in our consciousness for eons until the right conditions arise. So this is what we, first to get a general idea of the correct view of karma, we talk about these four things. First, karma is definite or certain. What does that mean? Let me propose a meaning of that, what that means. Karma is definite. Does that statement mean that if you create an action, you will definitely experience the result of that action? Yeah. You usually are right, but. Here the word definite or certain doesn't mean that if you create an action, you will definitely experience its result. Why not? Because that karma can be destroyed in our consciousness. Remember I said it's never lost, it doesn't perish, but that doesn't mean it can't be destroyed. For instance, if you create virtuous karma, if you regret it afterwards, the example I've given, maybe something I did in the past, you give money to someone on the street who's asking for, handout, and then you go to Starbucks or the hawker store and you don't have enough change, and then you regret giving the beggar the money. Oh, why did I give them that money? So you had created some virtuous karma, you regret that actually, that kind of regret of virtuous actions causes the karmic seed to lose its potential. Can even eventually, if you do it strong enough, can actually destroy it. Or if you regret negative actions, if you've done, you've created some negative seeds in your consciousness, and you understand that they, unless you do something to counteract them, they will eventually bring a negative result, bring harm to you. So one of the major ways to purify that is to feel regret about that non-virtue, right? So the Buddha said that karma is definite, the Buddha didn't mean that a cause will definitely bring a result. That's not the meaning. What does it mean? If that's not the meaning, what does it mean? Hmm? Again? Yeah. Did you hear what he said? So what it means is, say for instance, if you plant an apple seed, you will definitely get, if it ripens, if it grows, you will definitely get an apple tree. You won't get a pear tree. You won't get arugula. You won't get kale. You won't get potatoes. You will definitely get what is the continuum of that seed, the same type, right? So if you create virtue, you will, when it ripens, if it ripens, if it's not destroyed by anger or by regret or other states of mind that can cause the seeds to lose their efficacy, if it's not destroyed, it will definitely bring the result of something pleasant on you, which is experienced in your own feelings as something pleasant or happy. If it's on your mental consciousness, you know, we call that mental happy feeling of the mind, we call or a pleasant feeling of the mind, we call happiness. Pleasant feeling of the body, we can call pleasant feeling. If you create a negative action, what can I use for example of that? Like a poisonous seed. If you plant a seed, what's a famous poisonous plant? You know, the deadly nightshade, is that something? Sounds bad, I'm not sure. Nightshade, tomatoes are actually nightshade, aren't they? That family of plants. There's some plant called deadly nightshade, I think, that maybe is poisonous. Or there's some certain plants that are poisonous. If you plant the seed of a poisonous plant, it's not going to come up as a medicinal tree. You know, that all of the roots, the bark, the branches, the flowers, the pollen, all of which are medicinal and healthy. You plant the poisonous seed, it will bring, definitely bring, its own continuity, its own substance of, you know, of poison. So in the same way, if you create negative karma, and you say, well, how do you define negative karma? Actually, we define virtuous or non-virtuous, positive or negative karma, in terms of its results. That's how you can tell if some action is virtuous. It's going to be an action that brings a pleasant result. An action that we call negative is something that's going to bring a suffering result. So this, even this very first point, that karma is definite, if you start to think about that and you develop some confidence in this, some trust in that, you'll start to see that you want to avoid creating negative actions, sinful actions, whatever you want to call them, negative actions. And we'll talk about, you know, how you can... The Buddha talked about the 10 sort of general negative actions, most prominent ones, most common ones to create. We call the 10 the 10 negative actions, or also the 10 paths of negative actions. So you want to avoid those, and in the same way, because you want to have pleasure, you want to create virtuous, you want to plant virtuous seeds, good seeds, positive seeds. So that's the first step in Buddhist ethics. Having taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, it's not like you're just waiting for the Buddha to do something for you. It's almost like this is what the Buddha taught. What are you taking refuge in? Mainly his teachings, the Dharma. What's the main teaching he taught at the beginning? This correct view of the world. How you deal with the world is in terms of karma, understanding what occurs to you now as the result of past karma, what you'll experience in the future is the result of your present karma. There's a Buddhist expression. If you want to know what you did in the past, look at your present life. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at your present mind. Does that make sense? If you want to know what you did in the past, look at your present experience. You know, some of you are, many of the people here, you would have to say, I'm very fortunate. I have enough money to live on. I have a certain amount of health. I have reasonable relationships with others. Much to be thankful for compared to a lot of people in the world. You must have created virtuous seeds in the past, because karma is definite. For that result to come now, that's something pleasant, you must have created virtuous actions in the past. Not necessarily the very last life. It could be some way, way back there. It could be a combination of some karma ripening from recent lives, medium lives, way, way older lives. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, if you want to know what your future experiences are going to be, look at your present mind. Is it consumed with self-interest and egoism and hatred and distrust and, you know, paranoia? You're going to suffer in the future. You're creating negative karma. You're laying the seeds. You know, karma is definite. If you're planting these seeds in your consciousness now, in the future you're going to be suffering. So this is even this very first point is very powerful to understand. What's the conclusion of that? You want to try to avoid creating negative karma. Once you recognize what they are, and that's the next step. What are the actions that create negative karma? For instance, killing, stealing, taking what you don't own from others, sexual misconduct, actions of body, lying, deceiving others, right? Causing individuals that have some harmony to be split apart, sort of like slander or divisive speech. Very, very negative. Lying, divisive speech. Abusive speech, you know, yelling at others. Even you don't have to yell to have abusive speech. Do you think? Can you be abusive even with sweet words? Someone, you know, they tried to dance, you know, in the recital or something, or in the singing competition, and they didn't do so well, and you say, "Oh, you did so lovely." You know, can be actually abusive speech. It doesn't have to be, "You jerk," you know, "You're dumb," "I hate you." Those are abusive speech also. And idle gossip, even idle gossip is a negative action. Senseless speech. My actions of mind, covetousness, wanting to get what others have, making a decision that you're going to get it. Malice, malicious mind, hoping that others experience something unpleasant. Maybe even planning, you know, when the right time comes, you know, push them down the stair or to ridicule them or something. And wrong views about reality. Not believing in past and future lives and karma. Those are kind of negative actions. So once you recognize those and you remember this first point, that karma is definite, you want to definitely, use the word again, avoid the negative karmas. You know, just the same way that if you recognize that you've gone to a banquet or a buffet and other people are getting sick from a certain dish. Maybe there's some bacteria in it. You would avoid that, right? You know, just you would try to overcome your attraction. Say, "Oh, that, but it looks so good." You know, what's it called? The steamboat? It looks so good, you know? But one part of your wisdom knows that if people are getting sick from it. You know that the result of eating that will make you sick. You would avoid that, even though part of your mind is still attracted to it. So here, even though part of your mind might still have the tendency of thinking, "I should, you know, killing is okay," with the wisdom that knows it's a negative action, you overcome a natural tendency to do that. Okay, karma is definite, first thing. Second point, karma is expandable. what that means is, in a way, much more extensive than the worldly example. The Buddha gave example when he prophesied, when one lady, poor woman, old woman, gave him some little bag of grain. Very poor woman. She wanted to create some virtuous karma when the Buddha came around. And the Buddha said, as a result of this karma, in the future, so many eons in the future, you will become a Pratika Buddha, you know, a realized being. You will attain nirvana with the name so-and-so. And her husband, sort of real pragmatic realist, said, come on, you know, you're just saying that. How can the big, you know, attain nirvana? She just gave you a little bag of grain. You're just trying to get other people to give you stuff, you know, making all these predictions. And the Buddha said, you see that tree over there, he said. There's some kind of trees in India. I can't remember what it's called. You know, within, underneath the shade of the tree is so, the branches and leaves go out so far, under the shade of that tree you could park, they say, 500 carts. You know, not chariot, well, like maybe chariots, but cart, you know, the horse-pulled carts. A really big tree. He said, the Buddha said, did that tree come from really big seed? And the person not thinking, the man not thinking that he was already called out, he said, no, it comes from a little teeny seed. The Buddha said, even karma is even more expandable than that. From a small action, virtuous or non-virtuous, over time, as it resides in our continuum, before it ripens, may reside in our continuum for a long time, it continuously becomes more potent. And when it does ripen, it can bring an enormous result. So those who observe karma, that is, that take seriously this mundane right view of karma and its effects, not only do they try to avoid negative karma in general, because it will bring unhappy result, but they try to avoid even small negative karma. You know, you might think, oh, it doesn't matter, one ant, one cockroach, one harsh word, and they deserve it. Of course, sometimes we can't control ourselves. We can't avoid sort of like the winds of our karma is so strong from past actions. We create negative actions, even though we know that they're bad. So even a small virtuous action can have, over time, incredible repercussions, like the lady who offered just a small amount of grain in a little cloth bag to the Buddha. So this is the second point about the general sort of presentation. Maybe we could say the second noble truth in terms of mundane view. Karma is definite. Karma is expandable. So you don't want to create even small negative karma, and you'd like to create even small, even if you help someone at the market, cross the street, any virtuous action you create can have great results, positive results for you in the future. Third point I mentioned before, there's no way to experience a result unless your continuum, your previous continuum or your future continuum, created that karma, that action. So this has several repercussions. In terms of watching your own mind right now, remember I said, if you want to know what you did in the past, look at your present life. So if you experience problems, rather than blaming other people, there's no way that you can experience a problem, anything that's suffering, unless you created the cause. So taking your, even though the other person might be yelling at you, they've smashed into your car or something, they're like a cooperative condition for your karma to ripen. There's no way that this can happen to you unless you created the cause. Many examples in our, when we hear stories of accidents, maybe an airplane goes down and let's say it's carrying 200 people, 198 of them die. Two people miraculously survive. You ever hear stories like that? It's just like, having so many people die, only two people. So we would say that as a group, those people on the plane created some karma together in the past, what we call cooperative karma. Cooperative karma? Is that the right term? Was it? Collective karma. Cooperative, collective karma. Better. Collective karma. So as a group, but when we talk about how karma becomes complete and heavy, one of the important things is the motivation and how you feel about the action. Maybe some people in a group, let's say sometimes a wandering group of kids in the street breaking windows, scratching cars, putting graffiti. I know that's, you shouldn't do that in Singapore. I heard there was some American kid who got caned for, remember that? It was really, he really got a good whacking, I heard. So, say a group of kids, and one of the kids or two of the kids, they're going along with the others, but they don't feel right about this. Some of them are doing it with abandon, you know, cracking, breaking glass, or putting graffiti, or, you know, whatever. And maybe some members of the group, they're with them, but they don't, they're not really into it. You know, they're reluctant. Maybe they don't actually participate. So when that collective group of people in some lifetime, again, are born together and the right conditions, cooperative conditions occur, the people who are doing it with, you know, gusto, the negative action, they will experience some traumatic result, maybe a plane crash, they'll die, or they'll be incarcerated, or they'll be beaten, or they'll be put in the concentration camps of in Nazi Germany. The people who were part of that group but didn't complete the actions, they did it with reluctance, they just went along, they didn't feel good about this. They may be the people that are in the airplane crash that are not killed in the airplane crash. So there's no way, as that person in the airplane that survived the airplane crash, if they did not create the negative karma that the other people did in their collective group, there's no way that they could experience that result. So why didn't they create the karma? Because they mitigated. They were still in the crash. Probably it was a traumatic experience. You know, they may even have burns on their body, but they live, right? They're not killed like all the other people. So if they were part of that group, collectively... Oh. collectively creating some karma. But they had reluctance. They didn't participate fully like the other people with gusto, with, you know... They don't experience the full result. So there's no way to experience a result without creating the cause. So also, looking at the other way, the future. You want to be loved. You want to be successful. You want to be wealthy. You want to make, well, even beyond the world, you want to make spiritual realizations. There's no way that you can experience those results unless you create the cause. If you want to be wealthy, what's the main cause of being wealthy? Working, working, working? Is that the best way? Having a good idea to make a new patent something? Well, you might think, that's usually what the world thinks. Work, 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 work. 24 hours a day for some period of time. From a Buddhist perspective, that's not that's just a cooperative condition. There are people who work, and don't make a penny. Fail, right? Because they didn't create the cause. There's no way to experience success unless you created the cause in the past. Then there are other people who don't do anything. They're lazy, like me. Is that a joke? And because of some karma they created in the past, they experience some pleasure now. Renown, pleasure, you know, affluence, you know, many friends, riches, so forth. And so to the worldly mind, sometimes it seems, you know, totally illogical. You know, how, and sometimes it could even be a bad person. Sometimes people this lifetime who are quite naughty or really bad character have great success. I won't mention any names, but there's an American president. Anyway, I won't say anything. I don't know, maybe you have some sympathy for him. I have sympathy, also have compassion. But so there's no way that a person like that, even though they have bad character, they say bad things about other people, they do things that are destructive for themselves and others, there's no way that they can experience that result unless they created the karma in the past. If we want to experience bliss, you know, when we talk about bliss and emptiness, we have to offer bliss. Also, what's the main, I didn't finish before, what's the main cause of being, having resources and wealth? To give. To create the virtuous activity of charity or generosity. To be generous in both physical things and mind, you know, to be generous in speech, to say, yes, you're right, you know, thank you for correcting my fault. In the future, you will receive back positive things. So if we understand the law of cause and effect as it relates to our minds, this mundane correct view, we can start to correct our behavior. Okay. Karma is definite, so we don't want to create negative karma. Karma is expandable, so we want to avoid even small negative actions. Be careful and even endeavor to create even whatever we can, whatever positive actions, even if they're small. And in our own lives, when things, bad things happen to us, not to blame others, but to recognize, I created the cause for this. Remember when we talked about the meditation on patience? What was this meditation called? The arrow and the target? Remember when we talked about the antidotes to anger? Think, to take your attention away from blaming the other person or the situation. Think, oh, there's no way I could experience this unless I shot the arrow, created the karma in the past. And when you think about the future, so forth, you know, if you want to experience good, there's no way that you can experience. It's not just going to happen by itself. You have to create the karma. If you want to be wealthy, be loved, you have to love others. That can sometimes change our lives. You know, sometimes you wonder, why aren't I? How come people don't like me? Yeah. Oh, in the past maybe we weren't kind and offered others love and support. Now we're experiencing a lack of that. You know, reciprocity from others, that love. So if you want to be loved, you have to love others. That can be, you know, an eye-opener for some of us, just to keep that. We want to be happy. We want to avoid suffering. So we have to, knowing this third facet truth about karma, that there's no way to experience a result without creating the action, that we try to, you know, create those actions because we want those results. Fourth facet is that karma is never perishes of its own. It doesn't get rotten. It doesn't have an expiration date. can't get that word out. Expiration, expiry date, expiration date. You know, use before some karma in your mind. Use before 2036. Otherwise, that karma's gone, you know. Not like that. It will remain on our consciousness. I remember once in Dharamsala, when the Western Sangha, we were receiving teachings, all such precious teachings from one of the great lamas, Serpon Senchab Rinpoche. He was teaching some esoteric subjects. And the Western Sangha, I was a monk at the time also, all of us needed to have our visas renewed. In India at the time, it was a big problem. You had every 6 months you had to go and get your visa renewed. Usually what it amounted to is you had to put a couple of $100 bills underneath the blotter of some official who would then stamp your visas. So anyway, I'm not sure if I volunteered or if I was coerced into going to Jammu or wherever the place was to get the visa. I took everyone's visa and the papers and stuff. And I remember as I was going down, Dr. Nick Rubish, who was a monk at the time, he was yelling down the hill, "Don't forget, karma's never lost." So to sort of make me feel good about creating some virtuous karma, you know, doing this burden for others. Even though we don't think, even if we had limited clairvoyance to see previous lives, to see that we didn't create anything disastrous in previous lives, we don't know. There could be karmic seeds from numberless lives before that have not yet encountered the right conditions to ripen, both positive and negative. Also, this can give us encouragement in our practice. You don't know. If you don't have clairvoyance, you don't know what you did in previous lives. You might think, I can't make any realizations, you know. You don't know. You may be familiar with these subjects. Sometimes putting some effort into meditation with the right cooperative conditions now, you know, with devotion to the spiritual teachers, collecting virtuous, you know, merit, making pujas, purifying, you can make realizations because you have seeds in your consciousness that have not perished, that are ready to ripen. We don't know. Okay. So those are called the four general points about karma. Before I go on, any thoughts, any questions about that? If I were to say, Mr. Tanubrata, what are the four general points of karma? What would Mr. Tanubrata say? He would remain silent, like the Buddha. When asked 14 questions, he remained nobly silent. Okay, it doesn't matter. So, karma is definite, expandable. There's no way to experience a result unless you've created the cause, karmic cause. And karma never perishes, never gets rotten. Of course, you can say if you've created negative karma this lifetime, if in your youth you were abusive to your parents, you were naughty in school, you did bad things, maybe you hunted, you killed animals, and so forth. Later, if you change your mind, change your life, it's possible to purify those negative seeds in your mind. So we'll talk about that also, how to purify negative karma that's on our mind. Okay, any thoughts? Yeah, Mabel.
So... the concept of karma is very convincing, particularly for Buddhists, but it's based on the presumption that it cannot be otherwise. So if I were a non-Buddhist, I could play devil's advocate and say, if I have a choice as a human, why should I believe in karma? Because it's not proven, not provable anyway.
Right. Okay. Let's investigate that. Good point. I had lunch with someone today who had a similar kind of question. So how can we develop trust in the law of cause and effect? How can we develop trust or faith in the existence of past lives, future lives? Similar kind of questions. They're both phenomena that are hidden to our direct senses. We can't see that by giving that we will receive. Well, maybe because we can see people who give and do good things right now who experience suffering this lifetime. So the skeptic could say, well, look at that, George. This good family, always doing good deeds. Now the government has put them in jail. All of these things happen. We have there's a kind of expression. No, I can't remember what it was. Something like that in America, you know, why bad things happen to good people? Something like that. You know, how can you understand that? Sometimes the mafia kingpin or the criminal has all these wealth, big yachts, you know, fame and so forth. Doing bad actions, they have great result. So we have to understand, first of all, that the results are hidden, that the connection between karmic deeds and their results are hidden. Like do you know this fellow, what is his name, Ram Dass? Baba Ram Dass, who wrote a book, Be Here Now. That was in my youth. Do you remember Be Here Now? No, you're not anyone who went to India at that time. Did you ever hear of Baba Ram Dass? Sort of like in the hippie era. So he became, originally I think he worked with Timothy Leary on LSD. His name was Richard Alpert, I think the same one. And then he went to India to try to find some spiritual things, and he wrote a book called Be Here Now, you know, sort of like kind of quasi-meditative. Anyway, he created a system to help inmates in prison, and he wrote books to talk about spiritual things. And one, I thought, when I read some of them, I thought there was a good idea. He said that karma was like, you know, when you turn on the switch in a room, the wire that connects the switch to the light is hidden behind the plasterboard or the wood or something you don't see. But if you were to think about it for a long time, you can kind of see, if you see many examples of people, maybe if you have clairvoyance to see over many lifetimes, you can start to understand that certain causes give results. Use the worldly example of the law of cause and effect. You know, the physical actions have an equal and opposite reaction. Try to convince yourself. But the main way that you can develop confidence in these slightly hidden phenomena, like karma and past and future lives, is by investigating the Buddhist teachings about ultimate truth, about emptiness, about selflessness. This is something that you can actually experience this lifetime. Seeing how the I appears to the mind, and how the appearance of that I, coupled with our mind believing it, that generates our anger, our attachment, all of the unfortunate states of mind. And that by understanding that I that is being believed doesn't really exist the way that our mind thinks. Something appears, just like a mirage appears but is empty of water, like a reflection appears but is empty of the person that you'd mistaken. You thought there was someone wearing the same clothes as you in the door of the hotel. Turns out it's just your reflection. Or the echo of the dog barking. This dog barks and you think there's some dogs over there. You realize they're empty of... There's certainly some sound coming, but you recognize, oh, that's just an echo. It's empty of dog. There's no dog there. In the same way, when you recognize there's no self behind this image, appearance to the mind, that is so liberating when you have an insight into selflessness. The great logicians, Dharmakirti Dignaga, said, it's experiences like this, talking about the Buddha's profound teachings, but this very, that no one else teaches, none of the Indian teachers, no modern religion talks about selflessness like this. When I talk about selflessness, I don't mean as a behavior, you know, someone is selfless behavior. I don't mean that. I'm talking about the state of lacking some findable reality there, you know, selflessness. No one else teaches that. The Buddha taught that. Is so liberating. Why would the Buddha have deceived us about some simple things like past and future lives? Out of his great compassion, he went to great efforts to be able to accumulate merit for a long period of time. Well, we don't know that yet. Past and future lives. Out of compassion, he taught these teachings to liberate people. And as we start to feel some sense of relief and understanding of that, we can develop confidence in the teachings that are more simply stated and understandable. You know, when we talk about karma, it's easy to understand the words, right? It's not like, oh, I don't understand what you mean. You know, which might be the response if you talk about emptiness, you know, because you're talking about something very subtle that we don't have ordinary examples for when we talk about emptiness or selflessness. So emptiness, selflessness is very difficult to enunciate, but you can realize it. Karma, past and future lives, easy to explain, but because it's hidden from our senses, you need to have some special powers to see that. Clairvoyance, you can see past and future lives. The great arhats could see the karmic seeds in people's minds for a certain number of lives in the past and future. But we're not at that point yet. So it's said that you can develop confidence in the law of cause and effect by delving, having patience, practicing the Buddhist teachings of the profound, having some insight into that, and then sort of like, wow, the Buddha is a perfect teacher. You know, developing that kind of confidence. Even our practice of refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the Buddha is supposedly the teacher who taught the Dharma. That confidence, our refuge, is not something you take once, like some ritual, you got your refuge card, or it's on your, now you're a Buddhist and it's put in your passport, you just do once. Refuge is something that is cumulative. Deeper and deeper as you develop more and more confidence in the Buddha as being the omniscient mind is something that exists, something that we can attain, and that the omniscient minds of the past, the Buddhas as they appeared in physical form, taught us the methods to do that. And feel, you know, wow, you know, this is an authentic refuge. This I can take refuge in. This is, non-deceiving. Why would the Buddha, who didn't deceive us about the subtle subject of selflessness, why would he have deceived us about the existence of past and future lives and about karma? And it's not as though that just like some arbitrary teaching that he taught that you have no way to verify. You can kind of see analogies in the world. Cause and effect, you know? We can see, even though bad things happen to good people, oftentimes people that have good heart in the world, they're the ones who have the most friends. You know? We do see some kind of analogy there too. You know, if you do good, parents tell their children, if you do good, others will respect you. You know, even some people won't, but, you know, many, many people will see your qualities and respect you. So we see analogies to the law of cause and effect, karma and its results. And then to solidify that understanding that the Buddha taught this with confidence, with clairvoyance, you know, with omniscience, he who taught us about emptiness, it's difficult to understand, not obvious at all, no ordinary examples, no other religion taught. That's how that could be developed. Yeah. So this gentleman has a question.
I think a very good example is the current climate change around the world. The climate change, the extreme weather happening around the world, in Australia, Canada, Niagara Falls being frozen. These are all the result of human action activities that could have caused all these climate changes around the world.
Can you say it is
a karma that is happening now?
Let me just interrupt for a second. That's a good way to put it, because
we can feel it too.
Yeah, some people would say, President Trump the other day said when one lady announced her candidacy for the presidency, I think it was Klobuchar in Minnesota or something, it was snowing. And Trump said, oh yeah, global warming. Snowing. So to some people, they don't see, even in the world, the causal relationship. There are a lot of people who deny climate change. We could, and one element of climate change is the gradual warming of the planet and so forth. Some people who even deny that, even the evidence is so here. So, of course, something more subtle than that, the law of cause and effect, is more opaque, more difficult to see the connection. But I think that's a good example. That's a good example. Okay. Yes, you have one more question. You get one follow-up, like at the news conference. Okay.
Sorry. So from another perspective then, if the basis of Buddhism is about impermanence and emptiness, why is it that karma has this definite permanent quality and it's imprinted in our consciousness?
It doesn't have a permanent quality. So karma is karma is expandable. It's impermanent. The karmic seeds in your mind do not definitely ripen. Remember, they're definite in the sense that they will bring their own similar type of result, but they can be eliminated from the mind. They're impermanent.
But
if they were permanent, they couldn't be eliminated from the mind.
But they have a presence or an imprint that is modifiable.
Modifiable, that means they're impermanent.
Or impermanent as in they're changeable.
Yeah.
But permanent as in it never perishes.
Remember, we mentioned in a couple of classes this kind of confusion about the word, I can't remember the Sanskrit word, in Tibetan we say takpa, permanence. So in the Vedic religions, Brahmanism, nowadays called Hinduism and so forth, they believe that the Vedas, their texts on knowledge, the words of those texts were eternal. They used the same word, permanent, but they took it to mean eternal. So it was never lost. But there's a famous logical argument. Sound, because the Vedas are supposed to be sound, sound is impermanent. Or you could say not eternal. Sound is impermanent. That means it changes moment by moment because it's a product of causes and conditions. Sound comes about because of vocal cords or drum or whatever. So that syllogism, that logical argument, was meant to refute the Vedic proposition that the Vedas, the sound of the Vedas, were eternal. Remember, we talked about the difference. Like, say, the mind. Our mind streams have existed from beginningless time and will exist to time without end in the future. Even when we become Buddhas, they don't cease. So those mind streams are eternal. But those mind streams are changing moment by moment, being modified by new experiences, ripening of karma, creating new karma. So something can be both eternal but impermanent. There are things that are impermanent and not eternal, like my iPad, you know, or your car that crashed or something, or your car in Singapore, which has a lifespan of 10 years, I understand. Is that right? Can you have a car more than 10 years in Singapore? You can? You can renew? Okay. Maybe a very expensive car or something. Generally, if you break a cup, a mug is something that's impermanent, but it's not eternal. You can have things, so you can check between eternal and impermanent. There's four possibilities: that which is impermanent and eternal, that which is one and not the other, and so forth. So yeah, you have to be careful when we talk about karma never perishing. That doesn't mean it's eternal. It means that until it ripens, it will not disappear. It will not lose its potency. In fact, it increases in potency. Okay, so let me get to another thing. We'll start another subject here. So to go more depth about this, about karma, this is the four general points, is to talk about the actual non-virtuous karmic actions, karmic paths, we can call them, if we go into detail. So the Buddha talked about 10 non-virtuous actions. It doesn't mean that there are only 10 kinds of actions. I mentioned before, three of body: killing, stealing, sexual misconduct; four of speech: lying, divisive words, abuse, and idle gossip; and then I want to get 10. And then covetousness, malice, and wrong view, three actions of mind. It doesn't mean that those are the only negative actions. It means that to present to people at the beginning, to be able to practice observing karma, you know, wanting to observe, to refrain from negative actions, the Buddha said these are the most common and often heaviest kinds of actions. There are many other kinds of negative actions, but these were placed out there as a first approximation, okay? So, the first one, killing. I'll read a little bit from Geshe Zopa's book here. The Buddha, in his kind and skillful way, condensed all negative actions into 10 in order to make the practice of ethics seem easier to understand. If you train yourself to keep away from these 10, other negative actions will naturally be avoided. In this sense, the Buddha highlighted these 10 as the most important. Of course, other religions have similar lists of non-virtues to be avoided. In the Bible, 10 commandments, right? Turns out 10 also. That's a coincidence, right? Are they the same 10? Anyone know about Christianity? Anyone study Christianity? Not the same? Some overlap. You shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't kill. You shouldn't tell falsehoods. But then there's some other things that are different, right? You shouldn't make graven images. That's not one of these 10 non-virtuous actions. So the ten non-virtuous actions that Buddha talked about can be divided into what are called the three doors or three portals of our actions. All of our actions are either created by our body, by our speech verbally, or by our mind. Ultimately, all of them are motivated by the mind, but the grosser manifestations come through the so-called portal or door of body and speech. Many of the prayers, they say, I prostrate with my three doors. to the Buddha Dharma Sangha. So what are them? Like three doors. That front door, back door. It means, you know, you prostrate with your body, with your speech, you say praises, and you have a humble mind. That's the meaning of prostration, to lower yourself. So, a little technical point for those of you who have heard this teaching before and might want to hear a little bit more. In a text that a Sangha wrote called Compendium of Determination, this is not one that he brought from Tushita Heaven, teaches that these karmic paths, these 10 paths, he teaches them in terms of 5 categories. So, let's say killing, stealing, so forth. First, the basis. That might mean, for instance, the object to which the action refers. Say, in terms of killing, that might be the person that is being killed. The discrimination, to have a proper discrimination, recognizing that that is the person you want to kill. The state of mind, that is the motivation. The affliction that's present in your mind, whether it be anger, attachment, ignorance. Do people ever kill out of attachment? Oh, you can imagine people kill out of anger, right? How about out of attachment? Yeah, of course. Sometimes people even kill their loved ones out of attachment because they didn't do what they wanted, or they kill someone else because of attachment to someone. And killing out of ignorance when people sacrifice animals and so forth. So we talked about the basis, the discrimination. So the basis is the object of the action, which you're doing the action on. Discrimination is the unmistaken perception or correct recognition of the object. The state of mind is the thought, intention, or motivation that lies behind the action. The affliction refers to which of the three poisons, desire, hostility, or ignorance, produce that thought. And finally, there is the culmination of the action, the completion of the action. If the action is not completed, if you don't go through with killing or stealing or lying, you just had the motivation, it's not a complete action. So a Sangha talked about these 5. Lama Tsongkhapa used another mode of explanation, and he sort of condensed some of these. He said he condensed the 3 middle categories, discrimination, motivation, and affliction, into 1, which you can just say thought, and added a new category called the actual action. So you have the thought, which you might say the preparation. You could also call the preparation, because that would include the motivation, the affliction in the mind to do it, and so forth. Then the actual action that is being carried out. The preparation, the action, the completion of the action. I'm missing one. Thought, actual action. So 4 carried. Oh, yeah, still the basis. So the basis means the, in terms of killing, means the person that is your object that you're thinking to kill. The thought means, another way of calling it is preparation. It means the things you do before doing the actual action. Maybe that includes going toward the person, purchasing the knife or hand grenade or poison, whatever. The delusion in your mind that's predisposing you to do that. So the basis, the thoughts, which is you could call preparation, the actual action when you, with a knife or the hand grenade or whatever you're doing, the poison. And then the completion of the action would mean, in the case of killing, it would mean the other person dies before you do. You ever hear that before? To have a complete action or path of action of killing is still negative, even if the person doesn't die before you. You die first, still a negative action, but it doesn't have the same repercussion as if the person dies before you, because your intention in killing someone usually is that they, that you live through it. You know, they're gone and you're there, to gloat. What about suicide? Is suicide then killing? Full action of killing? You yourself are the person doing the action. You, if you're killing yourself, you don't survive after the you die. So that's not, even though suicide is a very negative action, it is not, it is said to be not a complete path of action. A complete path of action has these four elements that Lama Tsongkhapa said. The basis, it has a correct object. The preparation, which means discrimination of that object, the motivation to do the action, and some emotion, some affliction. There's the action and the completion of the action. If it has all four of these elements, it can have it can be strong enough to impel us into a rebirth in the future, what we call throwing karma, propelling karma. If it lacks some of these elements, it's said to be not an entire path of action. Like in a path, if you're driving down the expressway and there's a piece of the road missing on the bridge, you can't keep on going, right? Unless you're Superman or you're crazy, you stop. So a path of action has to have all of these elements to be complete, to bring its final results. Generally, we also say there are four possible results from any, I say, a complete path of action. Do you know what those are? Do you know what the four results are? No. I'm going to ask you, because you're taking the exam. He's done the exam before. What are the four of any karmic action which has is a complete path of action? You have a proper basis. You've had the thought or preparation with its various factors. You've done the action, and the action is completed. What are the four results that can come from that?
I cannot remember all four. I can only remember some, like some that you have the possibility, some that you will not experience at all.
What do you think? Okay. What if I said, what's the usual one we say first? The maturation effect of a deed. What is that? What's the maturation effect? Or the ripening effect? Sounds like all of them are, in a sense, when the karmic seed ripens to a certain extent. But when we say full maturation effect, means when it has led to rebirth after some death, that karma can throw you into a new rebirth state. That's called the maturation effect or full ripening effect. Like, say, if you've killed and it has that full, all four parts of the path of action, you can actually be born in hell or as a hungry ghost or an animal, usually in the lower realms as a result of that, right? Then there are two effects. I'll give the fourth effect, the environmental effect, which when we talk about collective karma is the karma that create this universe. The existence of the planets and the environment and so forth that we've done collectively. When it the environmental effect, how it ripens on you, on yourself individually for some action, would mean your own particular environment that you feel that you have somehow you're stuck in, maybe smelly place or a muddy place, a place that's dangerous, where there's harsh sounds all the time. It's called environmental effect. And the two middle ones are said to be results or effects similar to the cause. So for instance, if you killed in the past, one might be the result similar to the cause as an experience. You may be killed, or your medicine doesn't have potency, doesn't cure you. You take chemo or radiation therapy, but it doesn't help. The other is called the result similar to the cause as an action. So if you've killed in the past, this is what we might call the habitual effect. Again, having the habit of killing. So these two middle ones are called the results similar to the cause. So you could call three. See my fingers here? Put these two together. There's three. These two can be split. These two are called similar to the results similar to the cause. They can be split. Similar to the cause as an experience, being killed, let's say, or having your stuff stolen. It's similar to the cause as an action. So you kill again, or you steal, or whatever. So generally, to have the maturation effect, you have to have a whole path of action. You need these four things. You need to have a basis, the thought or preparation, the action, and the completion of the action. So in suicide, although it's very negative, you don't have a complete path of action because you die at the same time as you die. You're killing yourself. You don't survive the killing, right, of the other person.
Excuse me, Verbal.
Yes.
What if in the situation when there's these two person is maybe they are fighting,
yeah,
and then they happen to kill each other at the same time? So that means the path of action is not complete, right? For both of them.
So, okay. Let's give another example before I tackle that. Say, for instance, I hire a killer. Sometimes people... I see on TV there's a morbid fascination in America with this kind of thing. You know, some wife wants to get rid of her husband, or some husband wants to get rid of her wife or girlfriend or something, and they hire... And the police stake out their, you know, they have the tape recording of them saying, "I'll give you $100,000 to kill." And stuff. So if you were to hire a killer and they killed the person that you'd asked them to kill, you gave them money or something, or you had power over them so you impelled them to do it, who gets the negative karma of killing? The person who killed or the person who gave them the money, or both?
Both.
So you agree? Okay, good. Okay. So from Buddhist perspective, we can create negative karma in three ways. Or we can also positive karma. We can do the action ourselves. We can cause others to do the action, like either paying or if you have power over them, like a king or, you know, someone, you have to do this. Or what's the third way that you can create an action? Virtuous or negative action. You do it yourself, you cause others to do, or you rejoice in the actions of others. Say, for instance, you read in the newspaper that someone has been, that your country or some country has bombed this other country you don't like, and you go, "Yes! We killed them! Yes!" So you didn't do it yourself. You didn't send money or have power to do this. You're just rejoicing in that. You know what rejoicing means? To feel happy in some action. That also creates negative karma. Oh, and also if you rejoice in virtuous actions, you create virtuous karma, right? So you can, for instance, you can do the virtuous actions yourself, or you can impel others to do virtuous actions, like our teachers give us teachings, and they say, "Oh, do these prostrations, or, you know, or make a Dharma center. You make the facilities for people to create virtuous karma. So you create virtue in so doing." So in the case of this rare case, I'm not sure. Two people in a duel, okay, or maybe, you know, swords or gun or laser gun or something. If we kill exactly the same time, I don't know, what's the likelihood of that? There's got to be some microsecond between them, right? one's got to die before the other. Maybe just, if you talk about the smallest time instant, it happens the same instant. Okay, I don't know. Still, whether you died first or not, still create very heavy negative karma. Okay. So, let me just go, just give a quick rehearsal of killing. So the basis of the action of killing must be another living sentient being. You can't kill someone who's already dead, right? It has to be a living sentient being. It must be a living being who is not yourself. From the Buddhist point of view, killing any sentient being, even the smallest insect, is an act of killing. Why does it have to be another sentient being and not yourself? Killing yourself certainly is a negative action. However, it will always lack the fourth element of a complete karma, the culmination, because the killer, the doer of the action, will already be dead at the time of the completion of the action. And we just went over that, right? Just reading what Geshe-la says. In order to have a complete karma, complete action, path of action, the doer of the action must be alive and acting intentionally from the beginning of making preparations for the action right up through the culmination of the action. When you kill yourself, you are obviously not alive at the end of the action. Therefore, the karma is not complete. Doesn't mean that not bad, still heavy karma. The basis or object of the action is there. The thought is there, including the correct perception of who you want to kill, the desire to kill, the affliction that motivates the killing, the performance of the actually killing is also there. But when you kill yourself, the culmination of the action is lacking because the actor is not there to complete the action. This is why a Sangha says in his Yogacara Bhumi, the levels of yogic deeds, that the object of killing must be another living being. If you kill yourself, it is still negative karma, but it is not the complete karma of killing. So, first thing is the basis of killing, another sentient being. The thought, this has several parts to it, right? The second element has three mental aspects of the action. The first is correct discrimination. If you want to kill George, you come up to the sixth floor, I shouldn't tell you the sixth floor, and you accidentally go into Peter's room, who was up there, and you kill Peter. It's dark, and you think, God, that George has been talking rubbish in that class. I can't stand him. And you turn on the light, and you see you've killed Peter. Is that a complete action of killing? Well, we didn't say so much about this. You have to have the correct discrimination. You wanted to kill George, but you killed Peter by mistake. So it's lacking the element of correct discrimination. So it's not a complete action of killing. Still, it's heavy negative karma. Like drive-by killings in the city. You know, sometimes people try to assassinate someone, crime boss or something, and they kill the other people around by mistake. So that is, those are experiences of killing, but not complete paths of the action of killing. There has to be a motivation. If you step on an ant, or you're driving and you're texting and you hit a dog, or hopefully not, but maybe you hit a human and you killed them. If you didn't have the motivation to do that, certainly you could be arrested by the police, you might be in prison, was it called, manslaughter or something like that. But if, karmically speaking, it's not a complete action of killing because you didn't have the motivation. If you step on a bug or something like that. If you go fishing and you pull the fish out of the water and you take a rock and you hit it on the head because it's wiggling around, you've killed the fish, right? You had the motivation to take its life. You had the discrimination, you wanted to kill this fish. There's the motivation to kill it because it's bothering you, and it's done out of, let's say, irritation or ignorance or anger or something like the afflictive emotion. Then there's the action of killing. the action of killing is the actual taking of the life, when the life force is gone, then the completion of the action is that the killer must survive the act of killing. Okay, that's called the completion of the action. I'll just say one thing about what's the next one? Yeah, stealing, for instance. The completion of the action of stealing, what would it be? It's the thought at the end of, you know, you had the basis, what you want to steal, some money or something like that. You have the correct discrimination of that. Yeah, that's the right one. Something valuable. You're motivated by a delusion, you know, maybe greed, attachment, or something like that. You do the action, you take it, stealing. What's the completion of the action in stealing? Pardon? The different theories. One is that you've moved it from one place to another, like a Sangha says in some sects. But Lama Tsongkhapa said, that's not the full thing. It's when you think, I got it. You know, you don't even have to move it, because you might, like if you steal, you can embezzle funds, right? You don't have to move the money. You just change something on the tax form or you know, forge a signature or something like that. But when the thought comes, I got it, it's mine, that's when the action of stealing is complete. Okay, so all of these factors can be applied to each of the 10 non-virtuous actions, paths of action. And it's very useful to do that, to go through that exercise, because then you get a better appreciation for what is entailed in creating a non-virtuous action. If you can avoid, like for instance, if you can avoid the completion of the action, if you can change your motivation before the negative action is completed, even in the act of killing, say you've shot someone and they're in the hospital, and before they die, they're seriously injured, if before they die you sober up, maybe you shot them when you were drunk or something like that, before they die you change your mind and think, oh, what did I do? I shouldn't have done that. You feel regret. You don't feel... So you're lacking at the end. When they die, you're lacking the motivation, you know, that they die before you. Even though you had that motivation at the beginning when you shot them, if that's not present, if that doesn't continue through to the completion of the action, it's not a complete path of action. So understanding things like that, you can try to, if you do a negative action, feel immediately some remorse, some regret for that, so that that prevents that action from being a complete path. Okay, we'll talk a bit more about this next time and go into some other subtle points, hopefully subtler points of karma, a week from Thursday. So not this Thursday, a week after that. And we're just past 9:30, but just in case anyone has some urgent question you want to ask, you okay? Okay. So let's finish up with a short dedication. Sure, you can think. My mind has this clear light nature. Go back to try to remember this state that we developed at the beginning, this clarity of the mind. Calm and clear and very decisive. Good laboratory. And think, this evening I've created virtuous karma in listening to the teachings with a good motivation. This will definitely ripen within cyclic existence as something pleasant. But rather than it ripening in some superficial samsaric happiness, I'm going to try to dedicate that. And what a, you make a strong motivation, in whatever way this ripens, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual development. Week by week, year by year, life by life, may this karma bring about the benefit to sentient beings, in that as I'm becoming less and less deluded, I will cause less problems for sentient beings, and as I'm developing good qualities as a result of this karma, which can only ripen on my own mind stream, may that benefit sentient beings. May I always be motivated to avoid harming them, to benefit them, up until the achievement of enlightenment. Through these virtues, may I quickly become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. Is coming up Thursday. There's a Guru Puja, and then I think next Tuesday is a special multiplying karma, multiplying day. So a recitation of the Golden Light Sutra will take place, I'm not sure, here. And then also in the evening, what is that? What's the other thing? Golden? Shakyamuni Buddha Puja. Thank you very much.